We have two passages this morning. The first one is Genesis 4, verses 1 through 9, and also Micah chapter 6, verses 6 through 8. Genesis chapter 4, verses 1 through 9. Adam lay with his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man." Later, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. But Abel brought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it." Now Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out to the field." And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "I do not know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" Now we flip over to Micah chapter 6, verses 6 through 8. "With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before Him with burnt offerings, with the calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has showed you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God." May God bless the reading and receiving of His Word.
I appreciate very much the opportunity to be here while Steve is still busy celebrating as the father of the groom. I'm very grateful to him for his graciousness in permitting me to share in these moments of his ministry. The story of Cain and Abel is a profound summary of the human story. Here, the first worship and the first murder are linked together as they are in human history. All too often, murder and worship have been tied together. The sacrifice of Abel is accepted by the Lord, and the sacrifice of Cain is not accepted by the Lord. Perhaps it is no more than the old, great old German preacher Helmut Tillich, he said, that the smoke of the fire of Abel's sacrifice rose and the smoke of the fire of Cain's sacrifice hovered along the ground. But the event itself, whatever is implied, sent Cain into a jealous rage, into a furious rage. He opened his life to anger and hatred, and they consumed him as a ravenous beast or a demon. Sin is couching at the door. Its desire is for you. That one must somehow master his jealousy, his anger, his hatred, or he becomes a victim of sin itself. It raises the question, if I say the first murder and the first worship are contained in these few verses. What is acceptable worship? What is worship that is pleasing to God? What is worship that blesses us? The ancient question is as modern as the evening news. When men fly airplanes into tall buildings to destroy the innocent and the guilty and themselves. When men and women, as each day in the evening news, blow themselves up with suicide bombs to destroy themselves or others, or perhaps looking at it from the way Jesus spoke about anger and abuse of one another, men and women destroy themselves by rumors and lies on the internet and think that in doing so they are offering pleasing service to God. Genesis gives us no answer as to why Cain's offering is unacceptable to God. Perhaps the answer is in the question, am I my brother's shepherd or am I my brother's keeper? But I think the rest of the Bible shows us that we will not and cannot worship God rightly unless we seek peace with our brother and with our neighbor. People make all kinds of false rules for worship. You think in the story of Jesus and the Samaritan woman in the gospel, the woman of Samaria asked Jesus, which is the proper place to worship? On this mountain, Gerizim, in the vicinity of the old Bethel, or in Jerusalem? It is not an academic question for that time, for thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of people had died since the days of Josiah, attempting to answer that question. It was a constant source of anger, of murder between two neighboring people. Where is the right place to worship? Jesus' reply, well, neither this mountain, Gerizim there, or in Jerusalem, for God is spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. Some will tell us that the proper worship has to be in Latin. I still know enough Latin to remember that cornucopia is Latin for horn of plenty. That it has the proper worship is in Latin, and they will divide the church over whether they should worship in Latin. And some churches insist that they worship in Greek. And some religious people say it has to be Hebrew. Others say the only proper worship is in Arabic or in the old German of the Hutterite sect, who don't want their children to even learn English, but the worship has to be in the old German, this sect of our Anabaptist forebears up in North Dakota and Canada. And some people prefer incomprehensible English. I've been in those churches too. Cy Campitt, who was a traveling salesman, a Jewish man, told this tale one day down in the economy store. Asked him how he liked he had moved from New York to Raleigh, and asked how he liked living in the South after New York. And he said, why, it's wonderful. He said, I would have happened to have been a millionaire to live as well in New York as I'm living in Raleigh. He said, I got a nice home in a nice subdivision. And said, my neighbors are friendly. They invited me to join the country club. He said, in fact, one of my neighbors took me to the First Baptist Church of Raleigh a couple of weeks ago. And he said, that was the closest thing to a Jewish synagogue I've ever been in. He said, I never understood a word of what they said in the synagogue, and I didn't understand a word of what they said in the First Baptist Church of Raleigh. And we get off on our tangents. Some say that if we're going to worship, we have to wear vestments and wave censers. I heard this just this week. And some say, well, robes will be enough if you wear the proper stole of the proper color. And some insist that you have to worship in suits and ties. And others of the contemporary thing say that, well, the only proper worship is to wear a sports shirt and sit on a stool while you talk. What is the place of worship? A particular denomination, and we get more particular than that. It has to be a particular style in that denomination. It has to be a certain kind of Baptist or Methodist or Presbyterian or Episcopalian. And they have to be allied with the right group. And we think their worship is false. Some people say you can't worship unless you speak in tongues, and worship hadn't occurred unless there are tongues, while other groups cast out those who speak in tongues. Paul, I think, addressed that. He said, without love, all of that is just noise. I'm sounding brass or a clanging cymbal if I have not love. I have preached in churches that were tumbling down, preached in the open air, preached in nursing homes, in classrooms, preached in mental hospitals, preached in formal churches, and preached in informal churches, preached in army chapels. And I think as a college freshman, I even preached in the city jail, going with the ministerial band to the city jail. But after a couple of experiences of that, I decided it was unconstitutional. The Constitution says there cannot be cruel and unusual punishment. And it was punishment both for my hearers as a college freshman and for me to try to pretend I knew what I was doing. What is the proper worship? What are the essentials of worship? I think the cross stands as a symbol for acceptable worship. Think of the upright of the cross pointing us upward to God, the cross pieces pointing outward to all humanity. Worship must properly begin with God. Humanity is not, cannot be the measure of things. I think the words of Swedenborg and his like are absurd by any measure. He said, glory to man in the highest. He is the master of things. Man with his little quasi bit of intelligence on a tiny planet in the midst of time and space. No, man is not the master of things. The Creator is the master of things. There's been a recent revival of what I would call militant atheism, and sometimes I call it evangelical atheism. Writing their books, making the circuit on the entertainment, talking about why there is no God. I think of Yuri Gagarin, and this, of course, goes back about 40 years when the first Russian astronaut beat us into space and he circled the moon. And he said, I saw no God, I saw no angels. As if any intelligent Christian expected to run into God or angels circling the earth. I would say to him and to the militant atheist, the God you don't believe in is the God we don't believe in either. For our God is the God who has taught us to worship Him with all our heart and soul and mind and strength, and to love Him and our neighbor as ourselves. For these smart Alex, it is all too easy to mock the careless and popular practice of religion in our times. I think of Charles Towns, the winner of Nobel Prizes in Science, inventor of the laser and countless other things, a scientist to the core, from Greenville, a graduate of Furman, recently honored by Furman and by Clemson as a scientist, and with their buildings being named in his honor. And Charles Townes begins each day with prayer and reading from the Bible. We begin with God. I think of the words that are found in Jeremiah 10:11. It's an old proverb that says, "The God who did not make heaven and earth will perish from under heaven and upon the earth." We begin with God, the upright. And we turn and see the horizontal bar of the cross pointing to all of earth's inhabitants. For God so loved the world that whosoever believes. The real measure of religion then is this relationship with our brother. It's Cain's failure to see his brother, to mock God and say, "That shepherd." Jesus once said, "If you're bringing your gifts to the altar and you remember that your brother has something against you, first go and be reconciled to your brother and then bring your gifts to the altar." I wonder how many preachers would be willing to say that now. All you people that are quarreling with one another and cheating one another, don't bother to bring your gifts to the altar. But it would change the nature of our religion. Paul would say, "If I have not love," all of the practices of religion, including self-destruction, profits nothing. Cain's problem is revealed in his actions, that he has not love for his brother. There's an old bit of poetry, almost doggerel, that's found in our high school literature books, Abou Ben Adam, which talks of the old thing, of the old sheikh, wondering as he watches an angel writing the names of those who love God, if his name is there. And he's told, "Well, no, your name's not on the list of those who love God." And he said, "Well, then, write me then as one who loves his fellow man." And the next night, when the angel returns, Abou Ben Adam's name leads all the rest of those approved by God because he loves his fellow man. 1 John says, "How can you love God whom you have not seen and hate your brother whom you have seen? The Son of Man, the King, is served by those who meet human need, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, you have done it unto me." "With what shall I come before the Lord?" asked the prophet Micah, "and bow myself before God on high." I think of one of the definitions of fanatic that one of my children used. He said, "A fanatic is someone who thinks God would do it this way if God really understood the situation." And we have all kinds of fanatics who think they're going to improve on God's way. What does God require of you? Micah spoke to an age of wealth and an age of religion, an age that would pass away, for it was an age of prosperity fueled by injustice. So he asked, "What about sacrifice? Thousands of rams, tens of thousands of rivers of oil, with the especially prized calves in the stall. Are these proper sacrifices?" Sacrifice, I think, can be overvaluing wealth. God needs nothing. If it by sacrifice I am pretending that God is served, then we are overvaluing the wealth we offer. Jonathan Kozel, in Amazing Grace is the name of the book, tells the story of a rich philanthropist in New York, uptown, who was receiving a reward for his rich donations. Uptown, while in the slums of New York, a child plunged to his death in an unmended or unfixed elevator that was owned by this slum lord. We're sacrificing people to our own wealth. We think that if we give to this and that and see our names emblazoned on buildings, that we have served God. Even, says Micah, if you offer your own child, your firstborn, for the sin of your soul, God isn't interested in that. Even child sacrifice. Dee Miller, in a little monograph she wrote, How Little We Knew, tells of her service on the mission field when she was abused by another missionary, sexually abused. And the reaction of the mission board, and these are people that quite often we know and admire, but instead of dealing with the evil, the wickedness there, fundraising reputations were more important than people and truth and justice. We might sneer at the story of the Catholic hierarchy that protected the priests that abused children. But we become aware, when we look at the facts, that we too make reputation, honor ourselves more important than people and truth and justice. And Micah says, He has showed you, O man, what is good. You know, I've spent most of my years teaching at one level or another, Sunday school, college, classes in the churches. And I teach the human elements of Scripture that you may learn to find the revelation of God. God has showed us what is good. We have a revelation from God. Many years ago now, one student, members of a very narrow student group, wrote a note saying he was taking an evening division class so he could avoid taking religion from the regular Furman professors. And he wrote a note thinking I would be pleased when he wrote that I was the only teacher at Furman University that wasn't an absolute infidel. And you think of the hatred, the rejection in that narrow group that is contained in those words. Of course, I wasn't pleased for the ones he was condemning were people like me. And we find that many others, not like him, but many others thanked us for making Christian faith possible for inquiring minds in a scientific world. He has showed you, O man, what is good. I don't think there's an absence of the knowledge of God that is the problem. It's our refusal to accept that knowledge of God. And what does God require of you? But to do justice. Amos, Isaiah, Micah, Hosea all stress this relationship with one another, a relationship that's trying to find justice. In the courts, in life, God requires of us that we be fair justice. Where Micah uses the term justice Amos uses the term righteousness along with justice, justice and righteousness. Micah and Isaiah include the word peace in their understanding of this word righteousness, justice. To do righteousness and justice, the peace movement has well taught us that there is and can be no ultimate peace without justice, without the attempt to do the right thing. And what does God require of you but to do justice, to practice mercy? That word is one that's translated in the New Testament, agape, as it was in the Greek Old Testament. To practice love, faithfulness in love, to be dependable in your concerns and cares. God requires of you to be fair in your cares and concerns, but also to be dependable, merciful in your cares and concerns. The third requirement is to walk humbly with your God. To know that God is God. To let God be God. To not believe that you can order the world better than God. And to walk with Him. And to walk with your fellow man. Let your fellow man be your neighbor. Let him be your brother. Seek fellowship with your neighbors, with men and women. These are the things that are essential in worship. That our worship not be connected with murder. What does God require of you but to do justice, to practice mercy, to walk humbly with your God? Our closing hymn, it is a hymn of decision. If you have a decision to share with the church, or you would make with God in the privacy of your being, is hymn number 788, Now Thank We All Our God.